Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good martinis for conservatives today. And we also want to let you know we're sponsored today by Patriot Mobile, the conservative choice for mobile phone service. Join the conversation. Jim, we did not have to stretch here. This is not just because we're heading into Christmas weekend. We want everybody to be happy and cheery and merry, which we do. But we actually have legitimate good news on a number of fronts here. So let's start with a triple-headed first good martini. It's not often we get good news at all on terrorism. It's very rare that we get three good pieces of news on the same day. So let's start in Italy. This is the New York Times. Anas Amri, the chief suspect in the deadly terrorist attack on a Christmas market in Berlin this week, was killed by the police in a shootout outside Milan around 3 a.m. Friday, ending a brief but intense manhunt across Europe. Stopped in the suburb of Sesto San Giovanni, north of central Milan, Mr. Amri was asked to show identification papers. He pulled out a pistol and shot the officer who asked for the papers. A second officer then opened fire, killing Mr. Amri. The person who attacked our police officers was killed, Interior Minister Marco Minniti said at a news conference. There is absolutely no doubt that the person who was killed was Anas Amri, the suspect in the terrorist attack in Berlin. As if that wasn't good enough, let's go down to Sydney. A terrorist plot to attack the Australian city of Melbourne with explosives, knives and guns, possibly on Christmas Day, is believed to have been headed off with the arrest of five people, according to Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull. Mr. Turnbull told reporters in Sydney the group was self-radicalized and inspired by the Islamic State. Five men, ages 21 to 26, were to be formally charged later Friday. Another man and a woman were also taken into custody, but later released. According to the police, the plotters had scouted Federation Square, a popular shopping and entertainment district, as well as the Flinders Street train station, Melbourne's busiest, and St. Paul's Cathedral, an Anglican church. All three locations are close to one another in the center of the city. Finally, let's go to Malta. Two hijackers who diverted a Libyan plane to Malta and threatened to blow up the aircraft have surrendered themselves to authorities after releasing everyone on board and leaving the plane. The Maltese prime minister said the hijackers had been in custody, bringing the dramatic incident to an end. So, Jim, obviously the troubling news is that there's a lot of Islamist terrorist intent and activity around this very special time of the year. But the good news is that the good guys won today three different times.
Yeah, anytime we can have that is a terrific day, Greg. I should point out, we've given, to take them in sequential order, we gave the German police a lot of grief and the German government a lot of deserved grief about the inability to keep tabs on this guy when the evidence started piling up that he was a threat. We should give credit to the Italian police and other authorities that managed to act quickly when he was found. The problem is that this kind of indicates how law enforcement is an inherently reactive institution. Its job is not to prevent crimes. Its job is to investigate and arrest and detain people once they've committed crimes. And considering the stakes of terrorism, we want to stop the terrorists before they blow somebody up. It's great that we can catch them once they do blow somebody up, but we want to stop the bomb, or in this case, the truck, from killing people beforehand. But once again, kudos to the Italian police. Australia is more an example of what we want to see from this. And we get less news and pay a little less attention down there. But they are as threatened by Islamist terrorists as we are. And they've faced the same challenges and seem to have fewer of them slipping through their fingers in a circumstance like this. And then finally, the Malta hijacking. When I woke up and read this, Greg, did it feel kind of like we were like in a 70s flashback?
Yes.
I mean, like, hijackings were very, very popular in that era. All kinds of radical groups, less Islamist, more nationalist, Palestinians. The Croatians got in on the act. It was all kind of, you viewed Puerto Ricans. If you were a small minority group with a grievance, you got into the airline hijacking business, which had led to some of the security protocols that have become depressingly normal today. Thank goodness all the hostages are released. Glad that the hijackers surrendered. Back in the 70s, one of the things that happened with these hijackings was efforts to get asylum, and that may be one of the motives here. So anyway, so glad that it's turned out well, and right before the holidays, we get a couple of happy endings that we haven't been getting a lot of lately, so we're thankful when that happens.
Jim, I think it's safe to say that today is the most positive day of fighting terrorism around Christmas since, well...
Happy trails, Hans.
Since John McClane saved Nakatomi Plaza. But
Actually, you have this depressing feeling, Greg, that like a couple generations from now, people will act like Christmas Day 1988 was the time. Like it'll go from myth to legend to people who genuinely believe there was this little known New York policeman who stopped an international team of terrorists trying to rob money out of the vault in Nakatomi Plaza.
Exactly. Exactly. What's still little known is that he did it again on Christmas a couple of years later in the Washington
area. At Dulles Airport, yes, yeah. With Senator Fred Thompson.
Yes. All right, let's move on to
it. Launched Thompson's political career. Was he handled that situation so well?
Exactly. Yeah, if you can handle that crisis, people are going to trust you to handle other important projects as well. Good point. Good point. All right, let's move on to our second good martini now, and more Democratic infighting slash public analysis, which other Democrats probably don't like very much. This one's a two-headed good martini. Joe Biden speaking with the Los Angeles Times and saying that one of the reasons Hillary Clinton lost the presidential election was because she never figured out why she was running for the nation's highest office. Quote, I don't think she ever really figured it out. And by the way, I think it was really hard for her to decide to run. As evidence, the vice president pointed to similar concerns raised privately by Clinton allies and hacked emails that were published by WikiLeaks in the midst of the campaign. But he said it was unfair to solely blame Clinton for her loss. He said Clinton saw a noble purpose in her campaign, feeling an obligation to help pave the way for women in politics, just as President Obama did for black people. She thought she had no choice to run. But again, he says she never figured out why she was running. Later, it says Biden said he had a sneaking feeling that Donald Trump could pull off a victory by the way he energized crowds in white working class areas like near Biden's birthplace of Scranton, Pennsylvania. Quote, son of a gun, we may lose this election, Biden recalled thinking. They're all the people I grew up with. They're their kids. And they're not racist. They're not sexist. But we didn't talk to them. So while he wasn't happy with how the campaign was run, outgoing Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, our favorite person, of course, not very happy with the Democratic National Committee in many different ways. Here's what he had to say to Nevada Public Radio.
I believe one of the failures of the Democratic Party has been the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, has been worthless. They do nothing to help state parties. That should be the main goal they have. And so I would hope that they will choose a chair of the Democratic Party who is a full-time person, not someone like we had with the congressman from Florida who was a full-time congressman and a part-time chair of the DNC.
Like that congresswoman from Florida. He can't even say the name Debbie Wasserman Schultz unless it just slipped his mind. So you got the outgoing Democratic Senate leader calling his own party worthless. You've got Joe Biden saying that the party's nominee had no idea why she was running other than to fill some sort of demographic obligation. So, Jim, the finger pointing continues, and it's delicious.
It is, Greg. I'm kind of curious. Have you noticed this trend in commentary from our friends on the left since Election Day? That before Election Day, it was Hillary Clinton is the most prepared woman on earth to be president of the United States. There's no issues of health or physical or mental. She is at the top of her game. She knows exactly what she needs to do. She has the best team around her. She is ready. And then since Election Day, it's like, well, look, what do you expect her to do? They didn't know what they were doing. She was confused. She did the best she could, but we shouldn't have had that expectations. That thing was always held together with spit and baling wire. What? It's this bizarre. So, I remember some of this in 2004, too, that everybody who said, Kerry was this great closer, and he was exactly, after we're like, look, he was a really weak candidate. Whoa, 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 George Stephanopoulos. You were not telling us that right before Election Day. It is a convenient explanation of that. The comments from Biden, I suppose it's possible he really did think this all along. It's obviously he was keeping that very close to the vest. If your candidate is nominating somebody who is particularly weak or bad or flawed, does it do the party any good to keep it to yourself? Right, I mean, to play, keep your cards close to the vest and not say, like, do you do? It's a little bit of the emperor's new clothes, right? If you nominate a really flawed candidate, do you serve yourself or the party or the causes you believe in by being quiet? I'm going to argue no, and I think my assessment of Trump throughout the primary and throughout the general election is pretty clear on that. You call him as you see him, and let the chips fall where they may. But I'm sure that Biden and lots of other Democrats felt the need to do this. Look, if Debbie Wasserman Schultz was so abysmal as DNC chair, and let's face it, the record of the DNC of the last couple of years might, but you know, for once, Harry Reid might have a strong case here. Does it do the Democrats good to pretend she's doing a good job? Like, you know, could Harry Reid have brought this up to President Obama? Or if he had problems with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, could he have communicated them to her directly during that time? Some of this is a little bit of convenient rewriting of history. But nonetheless, watching them all fight amongst themselves is it's delightful, delicious, and just gives us that warm, fuzzy feeling right around the holidays, doesn't it, Greg?
It does, and especially in public. It'd be fun, yeah. Fun enough if it was happening behind closed doors, but they're doing it for all of us to see. Ah, Jim, but that doesn't mean that the Democrats are going away. It doesn't mean that the liberal causes aren't going away. Of course, you've already got people sniping at Trump for everything he does, regardless of what he does. So the question is whether your money's going to fund all these people who want to keep the Democrats afloat and have them have better opportunities to win in 2018 and beyond. So is your phone bill helping to pay for that? And would you switch phone companies if you knew your current carrier was using your money to fund radical liberal causes, restrict your Second Amendment rights, or even promoting Planned Parenthood and their abortion business? What if there was a liberal phone company targeting conservative candidates and organizations? Would you want to switch to a conservative phone company to help fight against their liberal agenda? Well, the fact is your current phone carrier may be using your money to undermine your conservative beliefs. And there is a radical liberal phone company already spending tens of millions of dollars trying to defeat conservative leaders and fight for liberal social change. Well, Patriot Mobile is deciding to take action.
Patriot Mobile offers nationwide talk and text and high-speed data at competitive prices and donates up to 5% of your monthly bill to the conservative organization of your choice. You get the same quality service, the latest and greatest devices like the Apple 6 and Galaxy S7, competitive prices, and of course, the center-right causes that you believe in. Finally, a mobile phone company that believes what you believe.
Patriot Mobile is America's only conservative phone company and was created to fight for conservative causes and defend conservative candidates. Stand with Patriot Mobile and give voice to your conservative values with every call, text, and status update. Call 1-800-A-PATRIOT right now or go to patriotmobile.com/ricochet to sign up. That's 1-800-A-PATRIOT or patriotmobile.com/ricochet. Patriot Mobile, the conservative choice for mobile phone service. Join the conversation. And while I'm thinking of it, Jim, before we get sued, we should point out that the clip from Die Hard was from 20th Century Fox, courtesy 1988.
So if we haven't done enough for sales of the Die Hard trilogy set, because there are only three Die Hard movies, right?
That is correct.
Actually, is that a letter from the 20th Century Fox lawyers saying, actually, there were two more, whether you want to acknowledge them or not?
Right. They throw those on the DV box set, but hopefully for free.
You pay more for the set of three. But anyway, I have not had the chance to do this. I wanted to get you, Greg, the box set that comes with a model of Nakatomi Tower.
Oh.
I don't know if the top blows up at the if you put in like baking powder and vinegar, but nonetheless, I was thinking of you, Greg, and I don't think any other gift symbolizes the spirit of the season.
Oh no, not at all. And hopefully, there's little add-ons you can get, like most toy sets, like Al Powell's police car and Dwayne T. Robinson action figures, and also
more of an inaction figure.
Excellent point. Oh, man. All right. On to our final good martini now and back to serious news. But good news, Egypt has delayed a UN vote on a resolution condemning Israeli settlements in occupied territory after Israel asked President-elect Donald Trump to intervene. Israel contacted the U.S. President-elect's transition team after learning that the Obama administration might abstain in a Security Council vote. The move would have allowed the motion to pass had the Obama administration abstained. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi discussed the issue in a phone call with Mr. Trump. In a statement, it said the two men had agreed on the importance of giving a chance for the new American administration to deal in a comprehensive way with the different aspects of the Palestinian issue, unquote. The resolution submitted by Egypt called for Israel to stop settlement activity in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, which it said breached international law. It was to have been put to a vote on Thursday, but Egypt withdrew it hours before the meeting was due to start. The Obama administration has long made clear its opposition to Israeli settlement building, and there had been speculation that in its final month, Obama might have allowed a resolution against settlements to pass at the UN and not exercise the veto that the U.S. historically has done against resolutions condemning Israel. So, Jim, once again, Trump accomplishing some things while he's still a private citizen here. And it's a good sign that he's on Israel's side here. And it's also a little bit troubling that Obama was ready to slip one in here once the voters had already had their say.
Greg, are we seeing the emergence of a president-elect's veto? Right? I mean, it's not in the Constitution, case. But you know, when you have a changeover of power from a president of one party and philosophy to another with a very different one, it is kind of odd to see the outgoing president, okay, we're going to do X, Y, and Z, and the incoming president say, nah, nope, not doing that. You know, as we've seen with a couple of these things, this effort to bar certain waters from oil and natural gas exploration and things like that. Look, guys, you can try doing it, but somebody else takes over at noon on January 20th, and all you're doing is just giving me a longer list of things to undo and change and replace and reverse. So I myself would not bother doing things like this. Obviously, I have a different philosophy than the attitude of the Obama administration. Kudos to Donald Trump to saying, no, you know what, guys, this is not going to represent the U.S. government's position going forward, and I would strongly discourage the administration and people from going forward with this. You know, it does seem like a If the absolute apex of juvenile and immature responses to defeats came from the Clinton White House stealing all the W keys from the keyboards back in 2001, I think this is a more substantive one. But I think it's at the same heart of this philosophy of, well, the government's going to change, but we're in here till January 20th, so we're going to do what we want and not care. There's supposed to be a transition here, guys, and that does not include gumming up the works for the people who will come in and replace you in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, this is the presidential equivalent of leaving flaming bags of dog poop on the porches of people he doesn't like and then letting somebody else come around and clean them up later. This is very immature on the part of the Obama administration.
Perfect metaphor, Greg.
Not necessarily the metaphor I wanted to head into Christmas with, but there it is nonetheless. Jim, Merry Christmas to you and your family, and we'll talk to you again on Monday.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks very much for being with us today. Merry Christmas to all. And reminder to visit our friends at Patriot Mobile. Patriot Mobile, the conservative choice for mobile phone service, patriotmobile.com/ricochet. Again, Merry Christmas, and tune in on Monday when Jim and I begin our six-part series handing out the prestigious Three Martini Lunch Awards for 2016.